Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. On today's episode of Homefront, we talk about a rarely discussed subject. That is the persecution of Christians. Even though you may not think this is happening in America, when you hear our show today, you may pick up some tidbits that will help you understand what is happening and how to protect yourself.
I'm an American!
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we are joined by one of our favorite guests. We have Daryl Castle, an attorney from Memphis, Tennessee, the premier attorney from Memphis, Tennessee, I might add. Today, Daryl comes to talk with us about the topic of persecution, especially of Christians. So welcome, Daryl.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's mutual. So to spice things up right at the very beginning, I want to know what you think about the death penalty.
Under certain circumstances, I'm in favor of it.
I always was a big proponent of the death penalty, especially when it comes to heinous crimes where people do things that are way outside the limit of what should allow them to continue. In fact, a lot of people may not even be aware that rape used to be a capital crime. We have so lessened it now, and we've given most prisoners on death row about 20 more years of appeals before they even meet with their punishment. But as much as I have supported the death penalty because I believe it shows our respect for life, when somebody takes the life of another, that we say that is not tolerable. However, back in the uttermost recesses of my mind, there's a haunting question I can't get rid of. And that is, what if the standard of justice changes so dramatically that now Christians are guilty of capital crimes for being Christian, for their thought? And even though it seems like a radical concept in our society today, you don't have to be much of a student of history to know that there have been plenty of times when Christians were fed to the lions and people in the Colosseum would come and watch. There are plenty of stories where people have been hurt terribly just for what they believe. Just to get this in chronological order, many of us are familiar with the early church and how the persecution really began right around the time when they crucified Christ. But if we fast forward to the Magna Carta that just had its 800th anniversary and was put into place in the year 1215, explain to us how that helped protect people, because in my understanding, the Magna Carta was the first document that said kings are under God's authority. So what can you tell us about the way the Magna Carta changed the course of history for our freedom of thought?
Well, in two ways that I can think of. Number one, the basis of it was that the king is subject to something like the Magna Carta. The English had always had an expression up to that point, the law is in his mouth, which meant the king's word is law. But from that point on, the king was subject to the law, just like common Englishmen. And the weird thing about it was that King John, not only did he sign the document, but he actually accepted it. He adhered to it when he could have raised an army and sent them out and had all these noblemen hanged, but he didn't do that. He accepted the document, thus establishing the precedent and the idea that the king is subject to the law and is no higher in the law than anyone else. So that was very important. Number two, it was a decision that, at that point they had an evolved system of common law that we don't have anymore. So it made logical sense. And many of the judges and rulers and people like that were clergymen. But, it was the idea of civil government. And the fact that any official would be no higher under the law than anyone else. There you have it. And it later in under the Treaty of Westphalia, it was decided that civil magistrates would run government and not clergymen. And of course, that was a reaction to many of the things that were happening around the world, where Protestants were warring against Catholics and that sort of thing. Western civilization was a fine thing, and it's too bad that we decided here in the modern age to dismantle it.
In the broad overview, it seems like it was more common for Christians to be persecuted than times when they weren't persecuted. And in 1535, for example, William Tyndale, who all he did really was he tried to translate the Bible, and they wanted to execute him for doing such a terrible deed as that. He believed that people should be able to read the Bible in their own language. He was the first person to translate the Bible into English from its original Greek and Hebrew, and the first one to print the Bible in English. Tyndale felt that giving laity access to the Word of God was really important, and he was eventually condemned and sentenced to death by strangulation and burning at the stake. However, his translation formed the basis of all English Bibles, including the King James Bible, and many of the finest passages were taken unchanged, even though they were unacknowledged from Tyndale's work. Not bad for a guy who died when he was only 42 years old. His years were from 1494 to 1536. Not really a very long time, actually, to cause that much damage to humanity. But you consider right around the same time he lived, though his life was brief, we had Martin Luther. Martin Luther went through a tough time. The song he wrote that we know Martin Luther for best is "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." Some of the lyrics of that song go like this: "And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever." Now, this was a pretty bleak time when you think about all the charm of England, and it was bad enough to drive the pilgrims out of there. They fled England because they were afraid they'd get killed if they had their own church and it wasn't part of the Church of England. how do you make sense out of a good country like England? Some people would call it the mother country, forcing their people out. This was, of course, not related to Muslims. This was just the Church of England said we can't tolerate any other thoughts. How do we piece that together with making sense of such a nice country like England?
Well, that's interesting. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, power was just as seductive and corrupting then as it is now. And when you start to diminish someone's power by having a certain dogma that says, no, we know what's right and what's wrong, it tells people that there are things that they can't do. It's limiting to their power, in other words. But we're seeing that same scenario with the pilgrims leaving England now, as pilgrims are fleeing the Middle East and North Africa and so forth. Of course, not all of them are Christians, but at least some of them are, to escape war and poverty and misery and so forth. And they're certainly trying to get into England because it's welcoming, because, its official position now basically is, we don't believe anything except that there are no limits on the power of those who rule over us. That is the essential premise, and I assume the more people like that can be brought in, the better it is for those who run the place.
Daryl, there's one more gentleman I want to bring up for us to consider. His name is John Bunyan, and he lived from 1628 to 1688. That was in England, where he was persecuted and where he was thrown in prison for preaching the gospel. His birth occurred 8 years after the pilgrims landed in the New World. So you would think by then England was going to start to get a little bit better, a little more calm, a little more relaxed. He wrote Pilgrim's Progress, which was written while he was in prison for his faith. Now, here's a question I want you to consider. I'm going to read a quote because he had a lot of time to sit in prison and think about martyrdom. And here's what he said in his autobiography. I have verily thought that my soul and it have sometimes reasoned about the score and sad estate of a banished and exiled condition. How they were exposed to hunger, to cold, to perils, to nakedness, to enemies, and 1,000 calamities. And at last it may be to die in a ditch like a poor and desolate sheep. Now, therefore, Satan laid hard on me to beat me out of heart by suggesting thus unto me, but how if, when you come indeed to die, you should be in this condition, that is, as not to savor the things of God, nor to have any evidence upon your soul for a better state hereafter. Now, he wrestled through this question, what if I die? Which is a really good question for all of us. I'm going to continue with his quote. He says this, wherefore, when I at first began to think of this, it was a great trouble to me, for I thought with myself that in the condition I now was in, I was not fit to die, neither indeed did I think I could, if I should be called to do it. Besides, I thought with myself, if I should make a scrambling shift to clamber up the ladder, yet I should there either be quaking or other symptom of fainting, give the occasion to the enemy to reproach the way of God and his people for their timorousness. This therefore lay with great trouble upon me, for methought I was ashamed to die with a pale face and tottering knees in such a cause as this. Wherefore, I prayed to God that he would comfort me and give me strength to do and suffer me what he should call me to. Yet no comfort appeared, but all continued hid. I was also at this time so really possessed with the thought of death that oft I was as if I thought I might now have the opportunity to speak my last words to a multitude, which I thought would come to see me die, and thought if it must be so, if God will but convert one soul by my very last words, I shall not count my life thrown away nor lost. Now, this is a very valiant attitude, and we need to understand how horrific it would be to live during that time of England where you're getting persecuted for being a righteous man. Nevertheless, let me ask you, as a Marine, when you joined the Marines, people were more proud of this country and willing to die for this country. And that's part of the valor that comes with being in the military. How do you make sense out of the cowardice we're seeing today, where people will die for very little, where people today are not brave enough to hardly do anything?
Well, number one, when I was in the Marine Corps, it was a completely different time. And I don't know if you remember those times or not, but there were plenty of people who went to Canada rather than submit themselves to the military draft, or the braver ones just simply said, no, I'll just take my chances in jail. That was a very big movement. The military was hated at that time by many, many people. In fact, we were directed as Marines to not wear our uniforms in the civilian world because we were subject to attack and so forth. So what goes around comes around. But there are many, many brave people today. For example, the three men who defended a train crossing from Amsterdam to Paris the other day and thus saved the lives of many people by taking an AK-47 away from a terroristic maniac. When the French officials in the train huddled in the cockpit of the train behind the locked door, just leaving the passengers to their fate, these three men said, that's not the way Americans do things. And obviously the military, many of these men today and women, unfortunately in my view, but nevertheless, serve under conditions that were more adverse than what I did. You know, in my day, if you wanted to, you could serve one tour in a war zone, and then odds were that your enlistment, or in my case, my commissioning time would run out, and you could leave the military if you wanted to. But today, these people go back many times. I met a man just the other day that's been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan six separate times. So it is a very difficult situation and a very difficult time to serve. And as far as the public's honoring these people, I would argue that it's far greater today than it was in my day. But bravery and that sort of thing, yeah, we're comfortable today. We're very comfortable. We have just enough, even in our ghettos, we have enough to be content to live in poverty and misery and so forth. This is the way of our world today. But, you know, there are random acts of bravery around, like the ones that I quoted, and there are people out there that I read from time to time, like me, who talk about Islam and so forth. Not that I'm brave, but I read a gentleman just the other day that I read something that he had written about Islam, and he referred to the Prophet Muhammad as a pig. And that would be a frightening thought. I mean, just the things that I write, I get threats. So, you know, just speaking today sometimes, with the world being the way it is, you know, we are a global society, and you can write something and put it out on the Internet, and some nut over in the Middle East reads it. and starts rioting and threatening your family and things like that. So just speaking in many cases is an act of bravery that you really have to be careful. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. What we call persecution today is when people say things that are not nice. We have not seen ourselves go to prison yet for believing in Christianity. That's what we saw yesteryear. Where are we heading, and what do you project?
Well, I was called down by someone who was near and dear to me in the first podcast that I did on Christian persecution for referring to what's happening in the United States as persecution, and mentioning it in the same podcast with what's happening to the Christians in the Middle East and that sort of thing. And I accept a certain amount of that criticism. I mean, I did refer to it as passive persecution. I said that things like the attacks on marriage and the family who had a bakery and they were essentially driven out of business and impoverished because they refused to bake the cake for a same-sex wedding and that sort of thing. All those things as passive persecution. But where are we headed? I'm very fearful of it, to be honest about it. I'm fearful of the way the intellectual elite accept the arguments of Islam and that sort of thing. Christianity, in one sense, is condemning because it tells us that there are limits. It tells us that that God is in control of our lives, and he's left us a guideline that we should go by. And it tells power, the ruling elite, that they don't have all power, that there are certain limits, and power doesn't like that. And so I think very quickly we are headed for one world, quicker than we like to think. We're headed for one world, one government, one religion, one cashless economy, and one massive tax to redistribute the world's income to the people that these folks think deserve it more, so that we'll all become equally poor, equally impoverished, equally enslaved, and there'll be a separate class of rulers. But I think that's coming a lot faster than a lot of people think. It's the at least the start of it, if not further than the start, is going to be enacted into Agenda 2030, which is being debated in the UN next month, just a month from now. The Pope's coming over to make a big speech at the UN. He's all in favor of it and so forth. President Obama's going to be there. It's a frightening time to be alive, but an exciting time at the same time.
Okay, you're going to have to give us a little more background because I wasn't aware of this, as I'm sure many of our listeners aren't. You're saying that the United Nations is making plans for what we're going to do in 2030 when we haven't even gotten to 2020?
Well, yes. Most of your listeners are very familiar with Agenda 21, which was part of the Rio conference back in, I think, 1991. It was originally passed. The term sustainable development came out of Agenda 21, but this is Agenda 2030, which is, as the saying goes, Agenda 21 on steroids. Agenda 21 dealt primarily with the economy, with the environment. It was basically telling the world how they could control us by enacting certain environmental regulations and that sort of thing, and schooling all our children to be good little one-world environmentalists. But 2030 is going to extend the proposal for another 15 years from 2015 to 2030. And in that period of time, I mean, you can find all this on the Agenda 2030 website. They have their own website where they publicize all this stuff. By the year 2030, the goal is that there'll be no poverty left in the world. The climate will be perfect. There won't be any, quote, climate change. There won't be any private property. Everything is going to be owned by a benevolent world system. so that we are all equal, as I said before. And if you don't believe me, just go and read their website. The Pope is all behind this. He's coming to the United States to meet with President Obama on September 23rd. Coincidentally, he's the 266th Pope. They're meeting on the 266th day of the year to birth something, he says. He says that's what their conference is about, to give birth to something. And another interesting coincidence, a normal birth process for the human life is 266 days. I'm sure that's all just a strange coincidence, but it's an interesting one at that. And then they're going up to New York to speak to the UN at this conference. That's going to go on for about a week, where Agenda 21 is going to be finalized and then presented to the United States Congress to accept and sign off on. No Americans should accept it, but nevertheless, that's what's happening.
How does that affect us down at the ground level? Does anybody in America really pay attention to what's happening in the United Nations?
Well, it's a stretch to say that no one does, but I will say very few people do, because after this thing has passed, you'll wake up the next day and life will seem about the same. You'll go on to work, and little by little, freedom will be constricted and eventually snuffed out. It's not too long a stretch to look ahead. I mean, even I'm 66 years old. I mean, I could possibly live another 15 years, but my daughter certainly will. It's going to be a completely different world. Liberty-loving people here in America, I don't know if they're going to like this new one-world system with a worldwide tax to feed the failing economic system that we have now. As it all collapses, it's going to take what they refer to as money to save the system, and they're going to extract it from us.
Hi, friends. Do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net, and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. My website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net. Hey, let's stay in touch. There's a prepper movement where people are seeking ways to protect themselves in case the world should become dominated by evil people. And some of them are recommending hoarding gold and silver so that they'll have something to barter with. But there are other people who believe what the gold and silver will lose its value as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I wouldn't refer to it as hoarding. But in my opinion, gold and silver is a very, very wise thing to have. If in reference to your original question, the world is dominated by evil people. Everywhere you look, the world is run by evil people. And that's why it's getting more wicked every day. But yes, I certainly am a believer in owning some gold and silver for many reasons. I mean, I could quote you all the statistics that you're probably already familiar with. You know, an ounce of gold at the time of the Roman Empire would buy a pretty good men's suit, maybe two, and it still will today. But if you look at a dollar, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913 to preserve the value of U.S. money, the value of the dollar, but it's lost 98% of its value since then. But in the 1913, when the Federal Reserve was enacted, an ounce of gold would still have bought a man's suit, and it still will today. So I'll go with that. It's always been money. And more than likely, it always will be, because it has some value. It's something of consequence. It's not just somebody's illusion, somebody's confidence game.
Yeah. What do you think about other metals like silver and platinum and palladium?
Well, silver is a very wise thing to have. It's a lot cheaper than gold. The upside potential of it may be even greater, but yes, I would recommend that. Platinum and palladium are investments, and I'm no expert in precious metals, but the upside potential of platinum is pretty great from what I understand. Anyone who has liquid assets would be wise to have some of them in that type of thing.
Well, let me talk to you now about a field I'm an expert in. I've been hoarding Bibles for years. I joke with you about this, Daryl, but I own a Christian bookstore, and I have 25,000 titles of books and Bibles. I can arguably say that I probably have the best library of anybody who's listening right now. However, here's the crazy part. We never thought we'd see a day when florists and bakers and photographers would end up in legal trouble for their positions. If the homosexual lobby continues pushing this, I have books on my shelf that they would like to call hate speech, books that explain what's wrong with sexual perversion. It's in every Bible I sell, passages about how adulterers and idolaters and those who practice all forms of evil are not going to be in heaven. This is serious stuff. If we ever get to a point where hate speech is banned and it's wrong to even sell books and Bibles that have what they deem hate speech in it, we're going to be in big trouble. Even though it may seem very far-fetched to imagine, would anybody ever ban the Bible? A quick read of history would say, oh yeah, it's happened plenty times before. That's why William Tyndale was martyred, because he dared to translate the Bible. There are plenty of people who died just for making the Bible available. There are people who got killed trying to smuggle it into countries where it's banned. When people reflect on the fact that China is the biggest printer of Bibles in the world, a country where the Bible was banned for decades, there's something seriously wrong here. So what do you think we need to do looking forward to make sure that never happens?
Well, boy, that's a good question, to make sure it never happens, because nothing that you said is not foreseeable and realistic. These folks, they don't care so much about what you think. It's what you say that they care about. It's what you do that they care about, at least at this point. But, you know, the Bible is hate speech in Canada right now. That's our northern neighbor. For a pastor to stand in the pulpit in Canada and say homosexuality is a sin, that's a criminal act. It's hate speech that's punishable by incarceration. It's not far-fetched to think that could happen here. I mean, a lot of things would have to change, because there's still a lot of us out here who see it differently. But I have no doubt whatsoever that there's coming a time very quickly when, to use a common expression, you know, as Christians, we're going to have to man up and decide which way we're going to have it. I mean, I know a young man who's aspiring to start a church in some other state, and I'm trying to support him as he does that. And I asked him the other day when he was back in my city and we had lunch together, I asked him, you know, you need to think about this, because if you're a pastor of this church and you've got a flock out there and you're leading them, and I have no doubt whatsoever that this will eventually happen, because all these religious exemptions for gay marriage and that sort of thing are going to work their way into the courts, and they're going to be struck down as unconstitutional within a few years. But anyway, I asked him if a homosexual couple came to him and demanded that he marry them, what would his response be? And he said that he would hope and pray that he would have the courage to stand up and do the right thing. And I said, you know, unless you know right now that you're going to have that courage, unless you make that determination, you know, you shouldn't be out there starting a church. Because of these things, it's obvious for anyone to see that they are going to happen. That's the direction that we're going.
Daryl, you would think that the homosexuals would put up a bigger fight against the Muslims, because the Muslims believe in stoning homosexuals, and Muslims, you probably saw, were throwing homosexuals off buildings over there in the Middle East. Why are the homosexuals not fighting against this Islamic invasion, knowing that it won't go well for them either? We have two groups of people who both are responsible for persecuting Christians, yet they also want to persecute each other, and it's not happening. What's wrong with that?
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. And my theory is that they are allies, and they're campaign to destroy Western civilization. And in order to do that, they have to destroy Christianity and the Christian God. I could be wrong about that, of course, but that's what I surmise. I mean, the liberals, I shouldn't say liberals. I'll say the intellectual elite of the country, the university professors, the writers, the entertainers, the Hollywood crowd, they supported Stalinism, too. They were big fans of his. Also Maoism. You know, you see these people walking around with a picture of Mao, a man who killed 70 million of his own people, on a T-shirt, for the same reason. They're anti-Western civilization, they're anti-Christianity, and they're anti-God. You know, they don't understand Islam and what it really is. You know, it's they don't understand that that it's coming. It's coming to a neighborhood near you, and yes, it's not going to be very tolerant. But I guess their reasoning long term is that they'll eventually get around to them too.
It's hard to talk about Christian persecution and not get into the Muslim problem. It's bad enough that I knew if we began talking about them first, we would never get to these other topics. But I remember when they beheaded the reporter, and I wanted to watch it just to increase my knowledge of what's going on. And the video was all over Facebook anyway, so I originally wasn't going to watch. And then after seeing it show up in my news feed 100 times, I thought, well, maybe I should. I clicked the mouse to watch it, and I still wimped out before they got to the scary part. I couldn't do it. There's something so evil about what they're doing to us that my conscience wouldn't even let me stay around long enough to see it. We have to fight this every way we can, but why are we watching our country coddle them and be more harsh and severe on Christians every day? If we were going to apply the exact same standards to all people groups, the Muslims would not get all the accommodations and the Christians would be treated more fairly. What is going on with our country? Why is that even happening?
Well, that's a good question, but part of my answer would be the answer that I just gave. the destruction of Western civilization and the fact that we've got a person who is at least a closet Islamist in the White House. But there are things happening with ISIS or the Islamic State, if you want to call it that, in the Middle East that are worse than the beheadings, worse than beheading this reporter. I mean, this young woman, Kayla Mueller, who was an aid worker, she went over there as a volunteer to work in one of these UN refugee camps to help the people there. She was captured by the Islamic State, and she was raped repeatedly for 18 months by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was at that time the leader of the Islamic State. We know all this because testimony from Christian children who were being held captive with her chained in a room. Every night he would come in and get her and take her in and rape her, and she would come back crying for 18 months, and then he murdered her and made up a story about her being killed in a Jordanian bombing attack. But these kids that have since been rescued said that's not the case. They have captured over 5,000 Christian children. I'm referring to them as children. They're young girls. They're under 18 years old. I mean, they don't care. The Islam Council, you know, the Quran is all about rape. They say, yes, you can rape these infidel women. It's all in the Quran. You can murder them. You can enslave them. It's perfectly okay. But nothing is done about it. It's an outrage, and it really is horrible. It's a sickening sight, and it sickens me that our society has reached such depths of depravity that we would tolerate something like that to go on. I don't understand it. I really don't.
At the foundational level, we have to oppose those who are opposing our Constitution. And when the Muslims come over here and say, we want Sharia law, the two are mutually exclusive. You cannot have both the Constitution of the United States, which says we have freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and the Sharia law that says you don't have freedom of speech and you don't have freedom of religion. It's impossible for coexistence to happen when one group of people says, let's all be nice to each other, and the other group of people says, let's kill anybody who doesn't become a Muslim. How are we going to go forward? And when will that cataclysmic point come when people have to decide what we're going to believe anymore?
Well, the answer to that last question is I'm not certain, but Islam is coming, and Islam does teach that the whole world will submit to Islam. By submission, I mean you either accept Islam and convert, or you put to death, or in the more generous Islamic areas, you can pay a tax, which is a passive form of submission. But you will submit to Islam. But as far as the first question, when you're talking about Sharia law in America, I mean, my question for those people, if I were in a position of authority, would be, are you an American citizen? And if the answer to that's no, my answer would be, then you're deported immediately. But if you are an American citizen, then the answer is no, absolutely not, under no circumstances. It seems pretty simple to me. But when it will happen, you know, Winston Churchill was quoted as saying once that Americans always do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every other possibility. So with Islam, I just pray to God that it's not too late, but it is coming.
So give us some action points. I can't let you leave to go back to your law office without you first telling us what should we do. Give us a marching order.
What should we do as individuals? You know, Cynthia, we still have the right to vote. That's something that they've left us. It's not what it used to be because they control the democratic process by restricting access to the ballot to Democrats and Republicans in most states, in enough states to keep us from really getting enough states to really prosper. But nevertheless, we still have some right to vote, and we should consider very carefully the fact that no Democrat or Republican is going to dismantle this system. It's just not going to happen. I don't care who it is. they're not going to destroy their own power base. It's just human nature. So you're going to have to go outside that system. And I would submit to you that a Constitution Party candidate would be the best one. You can hold these people up to the celebrities that you see on TV that masquerade as our politicians now. But I have never met a Constitution Party candidate who was not a decent, honorable American who loved this country, not a single one. So that's what I would recommend as a start. You know, number two, my own theory is that people need to examine themselves and pray to God that he will create in them a pure heart, because there's a time coming very quickly when life as we know it in America is going to change radically. That's not very far away at all, in my view. Those are two places that we could start. You know, there used to be an old saying in Christianity many years ago that, people would talk about revival in America and that sort of thing. And if there is such a thing, the saying went, let it start in me. You know, each one of us individually has to start there before it can start somewhere else. But, maybe God's not through with us. Maybe he is. We have turned our back on him. And personally, I don't think we're going to escape that. So that'd be my advice.
Yeah, there have been plenty of civilizations that have done less than this in terms of shaking their fist at God, who have met with much more severe judgment than what we're getting. When you think about it, the Lord's been very merciful to this country. He has given us more privileges than any other nation in history. And what we have done with it is embarrassing. How much we have squandered, how many blessings we've received, and how we've not fully utilized it to turn it around and thank him and honor him for all he's done. We are acting like we're asking for it, but the rest of the story will come later. You've been a delight. Is there one last parting thought you want everybody in America to know?
Well, that's a good one. I used to say circle the wagons, but I'm not going to say that anymore. I'll say, pray and ask God to examine your own life and be strong in the Lord, because you're going to need to be in the near future. Watch out. In September, this UN conference and many other things, there's kind of a confluence of events coming to pass, starting with the 15th of September. It bears watching. Our future is not going to be the same after that. So I guess that would be my parting thought.
We'll watch for September. We have a lot of fun things on my calendar for September, but I mentioned this to my daughter. I actually have a wedding anniversary September 20th, and then I have two children who have birthdays September 23rd. And as many books and articles as I've read about September 23rd, I chuckle when I think about it, because once a book is written or an article predicting the date, it usually never happens.
Well, let's hope Agenda 2030 doesn't happen, but I'm very much afraid that it will.
Good. Well, we'll find out. Daryl, thank you for being a blessing and a delight and taking a few minutes to enlighten us. This has been great.
All right, Cynthia, you're very welcome.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.